Good morning. The court will now hear oral argument in the case of United States v. Kreutzer.
Thank you, Chief Judge Baker, members of the court. I'm Captain Barbara Snow Martone, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Potter, we represent appellant. Locked in his cell on death row for 23 of 24 hours of the day, each day, for 280 days, with no interaction with other human beings. Conditions that caused him to inquire with his command regarding when he would be released from death row. That was appellant's existence 30 days after the Army Court set aside his sentence to death. After the Army Court denied the government's motion for reconsideration, after appellant made multiple inquiries to confinement officials to be released from death row, and after TJAG ordered the commandant of USDB to release Sergeant Kreutzer from death row. It was only once this court took action on January 5, 2005, that the commandant placed appellant into medium custody, where appellant, just like while on death row, was a model inmate. All along, the government provided no explanation for its actions or inactions. The government failed altogether to rebut evidence that, one, the conditions of death row were necessary to ensure Sergeant Kreutzer's attendance at trial. The government concedes this fact in its brief at page 7. And two, that the commandant intended to punish appellant by leaving him on death row. Importantly, there are three independent grounds upon which this court could and should grant appellant Article 13 confinement credit. One, the commandant's violation of AR-190-47 pertaining to military corrections is a regulation that inter alia prohibits commingling death row prisoners with non-death row prisoners. That provision is mandatory and does not afford confinement officials' discretion. Two, the unduly rigorous conditions attendant to appellant's death row status. And three, the commandant's intent to punish appellant by keeping him on death row.
Pertaining just to be clear, who are we reviewing here? Are we reviewing the commandant's decision, a military judge's decision, the CCA's decision?
Both, Your Honor. Ultimately, you're reviewing the commandant's decision to the extent the military judge failed to put any findings of fact in the record upon which an abuse of discretion analysis could be afforded. And ultimately, his conclusions of law were based on a clearly erroneous view of the law. So because of both of those cases or instances, it's a de novo review in this particular case.
Okay. Number three. Where is there an intent to punish?
There's an intent to punish, Your Honor, when you look at various circumstances, particularly looking at the commandant and his inaction, Sergeant Kreutzer. The appellant had made multiple inquiries to his command in a two-month period of time. During that juncture, the commandant, as his commander, took no action to rectify or otherwise explain.
Well, you're saying he did nothing. An intent to punish is something positive.
He kept him on death row, Your Honor, despite the fact that my client was inquiring as to why am I still on death row. He did nothing in response to TJAG's June 22, 2004 order to release my client from death row. And although that was eventually revoked 3 weeks later, there was a three-week time frame where absolutely nothing was done. Getting back to my client's inquiries to the commandant, the most explanation, which was not an explanation at all as to why he was left on death row, was you will stay on death row until the appellate process is complete. That's not responsive to why death row was...
Well, it may not be responsive, but is it illogical or irrational?
Based on the state of the law, appellant maintains that it was. It was not supported by the law. When you look to United States versus Miller, it was clear that there's a 30-day period of time in which a set-aside sentence is inchoate, or the accused interest in that sentence being set aside is inchoate. After the 30-day period of time, one of two things has to happen. The person either has to be afforded a pretrial confinement review, or they have to be released from pretrial confinement. In this case, appellant doesn't maintain that releasing him altogether from confinement would be appropriate. He understands that he was still facing...
Well, isn't this a case, in fact, where they didn't hold a hearing when they should have?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
In this... really boil down to they should have held the hearing before they did the 305 hearing.
That's an additional indication of intent to punish. That's not the only...
It's an indication of an intent to punish?
Because it was, the law was clear that this should have occurred. The commandant was told to do this, did not do it for a period of months. In fact, a real pretrial confinement review on the appellant's case didn't happen until January of 2006, much, much later, even after he was ordered to have such a hearing. The hearing that he purported to have allowed the appellant to submit a letter on his behalf, or his trial defense counsel submitted a letter on his behalf. But it's clear that the commandant didn't take into consideration that letter. He didn't make any finding, or he didn't make any determination as to the propriety of keeping my client on death row. All he said in his confinement review memo was there are reasons to keep you in pretrial confinement. You're facing particular charges. We believe you committed the standard pretrial confinement memo. Nothing, again, of his death row status.
Counsel, I was a little confused as to what the accused status was. You say he was in pretrial confinement. I'm not after. But he was still a convicted service member, wasn't he?
He was, Your Honor.
So he wasn't awaiting trial on the whether he was guilty or not.
You have to parse it out, Your Honor. He was, as to those findings and the sentence that was set aside, he at the most was in pretrial confinement status. He was post-trial as to those offenses of which he still stood convicted.
But he was unsentenced as to them?
Unsentenced,
okay.
As to those as well.
Now, the second thing that, when I was reviewing this, crossed my mind is, what is the basis for credit for, assuming it's illegal or intended to punish, what's the basis for credit?
Article 13 of the UCMJ, Your Honor, and then depending on one of the three bases for providing my client relief, it would be Article 13 of the UCMJ and RCM 305K.
How is I'm sorry. Were you happy, Walter? Judge Cox?
Yeah, well, I was just wondering what the basis for the credit was. It's not in the statute.
Right. It's prescribed. The basis is RCM 305.
And so it's in RCM 305, so the president is the one that gives credit.
That's correct. Well, ultimately, it's the trial judge who has discretion. In this case, though, based on his erroneous view of the law, this court needs to look directly at the commandant's actions and what transpired below, kind of looking past the military judge's ruling.
How do you address Sarbatani, then, in your case, when you have a life sentence?
There is a potential for his life sentence to be commuted or for him to have a definite period of confinement time in terms of years in the future. So meaningful relief can certainly still be afforded my client if you award the confinement credit that's being asked.
So the theory is you put the confinement credit on the book, and if anything ever happens that would change that sentence, so it's a something out of wills and estates, a contingency to occur or something?
Right, and that's envisioned in Army regulation pertaining to Army regulation pertaining to confinement credit in terms of my client, unfortunately, being sentenced to life with the possibility of parole, can't get good time credit, but he can get employment credit that is kind of stayed until such time as he gets a term of years. So it would be akin to that, Your Honor.
Now, you made a couple of arguments at the outset referring to regulation, unduly rigorous portion of Article 13. Where in the record were those arguments made before the military judge, and where in the record, those arguments having been made, did the military judge err in addressing them?
He absolutely did err in not addressing them, Your Honor, although they were not raised as ardently as were the intent to punish, as was the intent to punish argument. It was sufficiently raised. When you look at the motion filing by the Trial Defense Counsel, they cite to the applicable law pertaining to unduly rigorous conditions. So
you rely on the motion memo as the basis for having put it before the military judge.
And also recognizing that just a straight-faced reading of Article 13 allows for confinement credit, or Article 13 looks to two separate factors. So any military judge who's looking at an Article 13 motion should consider those two factors.
And judge should assume without any further facts that death row is more rigorous than necessary?
Your Honor, there was...
Where is that demonstrated?
The facts were demonstrated, Your Honor, in several respects in the record. The evidence that came out At the front, at the forefront, is this court's January 5th, 2004 CAF order, indicating that there was a violation of the regulation and my client should be released from death row. That's indicia that his current status on death row was inappropriate, and therefore the command needed to put him in appropriate confinement. Also, the egregious conditions of death row itself, being in solitary confinement for 23 of 24 hours a day, to ensure my client gets to preach.
And that's from the regulation. Where is that established in the record?
The 23 hours a day. First Lieutenant Ari Alano, in his affidavit that was submitted by the defense to the judge, indicated that solitary confinement.
Would you say that's your strongest evidence on the more rigorous than necessary?
In addition to that, Your Honor, TJI acknowledged that my client should be taken off death row, that it was inappropriate for him to remain on there. As a result, he ordered he be taken off on June 22, 2004. In addition, in April of 2004, there was evidence submitted that the military judge had that indicated that my client actually was more fit for medium custody. That, again, was in April 2004, not long after the Army Court set aside his death sentence. And then in addition to that, to the extent you can look at it post hoc, Sergeant Pertzer showed up for a second trial after being on medium custody. Moreover, my client, through his trial defense counsel, informed the commandant, reminded him that one of my client's predecessors on death row had been taken off of death row and put into medium custody, general population, as a result of his sentence being set aside before the appellate process had run its course.
Where does the 2,800 days come from? Is that pulled out of the air? I mean, it's obviously 280 times 10, but... Are you aware of a case in which this court sanctioned 10-for-1 credit?
I'm not. I am aware of the court sanctioning 4 days credit for each day. It all depends on the circumstances, and there is discretion here. That the military judge, had he been applying the law correctly, very well could have awarded.
10-for-1?
On a death row status, Your Honor, in solitary.
10-for-1?
When your death sentence has been set aside and you're still essentially commingled with other death row inmates, so your status is that of being condemned to death? In addition to...
No, his status wasn't that of being condemned to death. His status was that of being mingled.
Commingled and also denied the ability for rehabilitative programs, which my client took full advantage of once he was eventually put into medium custody. In fact, he facilitated a therapy group for everyone in his medium custody group. Getting back to the intent to punish, Your Honors, in addition to doing nothing in response to TJAD's order and doing nothing to confirm the propriety of my client staying on death row pending his appeal, the Commandant and his designees did nothing of substance to respond to my client's multiple inquiries. And although we recognize that inquiries alone are not indicia of punishment, in this case it was clear that my client was continually inquiring as to his status, why he was left on death row, and the command did nothing to really respond to that. Ultimately, the Commandant violated multiple provisions of AR-190-47. In addition to commingling my client with death row inmates, he also failed to follow paragraph 10-14 of 190-47, which required him to provide definite responses to the inquiries that were made to him. Moreover, it took the Commandant an additional 9 days after this court's order releasing him, my client, from death row to actually release him from death row and put him on medium custody. Underlying all of this, Your Honors, is the fact that the government provided not one explanation at the motion hearing as to how to keep my client on death row under the attendant conditions of that sex status further the legitimate government objective. Whatever his mistaken understanding of the law could have been, the Commandant's purported pretrial confinement review did not establish why Appellant's continued confinement on death row was warranted to ensure his presence at trial. Any of your questions, Your Honors? I'd like to reserve the remainder for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Chief Judge Baker, judges of the court, may it please the court, I'm Captain Chad Fisher, and I, along with Major Ellen Jennings, represent the United States. This court should find that the military judge properly denied the appellant's Article 13 motion because the appellant failed to prove either that his command intended to punish him or unduly rigorous circumstances during his detention, which might give rise to the inference that he was punished. Now, there were really two legal issues in this case. The first issue is, at what point was appellant required to be removed from death row?
You should have held it. You held a hearing eventually under 305.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why wasn't it held when it was supposed to be held?
Your Honor, I think it was held when it was supposed to be held.
It was held when it was supposed to be held?
Yes, Your Honor.
How so?
I understand appellant's interpretation of Miller is that it establishes a 30-day hard rule. So 30 days after the CCA decision is when the appellant converted to a pretrial status. But Miller is, number one, not factually on point. And number two, it relies on two assumptions that don't always hold true. The first is that the period for reconsideration will always be 30 days. We know, pursuant to CCA Rule 19 Delta, that the time for reconsideration can be extended up to 60 days. And the second assumption in Miller is that the time periods for reconsideration and certification run concurrently. We know that they can run consecutively. So in situations like appellants, where we have both an extension for the time to reconsider, reconsideration, and certification, is the government's position that he converts to a pretrial prisoner at the time that TJAG certified the case. And I think that's consistent with United States v. Crawford, where this court had said that a CCA's decision remains inchoate until the possibility for reconsideration is removed. So, understanding appellant's argument, I know it's not unreasonable based on the language of Miller, but again, Miller is not factually on point, and we have those assumptions in Miller that I don't think always hold true.
When you introduced your topic, you said that the prong two, more rigorous than circumstances required to ensure his presence, related to prong one, that would prove an intent to punish. Are you arguing that you can hold someone in circumstances more rigorous than required as long as you don't intend to punish them?
No, Your Honor, I think those are two separate bases. But I think my argument is that there's no evidence here of what the conditions were. So in order to determine if conditions
are... The second half of Article 13 is freestanding.
And again, our argument on prong two is we can't determine if the conditions are unduly rigorous if we don't know what they were.
Well, isn't there evidence in the record as to what the conditions were? But and I have some examples here, but before I get to that, is it the government's position that being on death row is not more rigorous than being in general population?
Your Honor, I couldn't tell you from looking at the record. To be honest with you, I know the appellant spoke of 23 hours a day in his cell, solitary confinement, but I can't find that in the record.
Well, in Appellate Exhibit 273, which is the motion, I think, for relief, it did state that he was required to wear an orange jumpsuit, was placed in hand irons when outside his living quarters, placed in full restraints when outside death row. That's not something that happens in the general population. And then there was another affidavit, I think at JA573, where it detailed the difference in living conditions, the recreational opportunities, and the access to group therapy and pretrial inmates. So the record does have at least something in there, and I think that it's not unreasonable for us to recognize that they wouldn't have death row if there wasn't some difference in status.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure. The first piece, if you're referring just to AE 273, I mean, if that statement is just in the appellant's motion, then motions are not evidence. An appellant would not have met his burden just by simply writing that in his pleading. But I do understand Lieutenant Arellano's affidavit, which is evidence, and I understand that. But I think there's a couple problems with that. The first is Lieutenant Arellano was the NCOIC of the Mental Health Division. So I'm not sure that he has the basis of knowledge to describe exactly what all the conditions were on death row, but looking at it from the other way.
So the government official that deals with some of this stuff isn't credible? Is that what you're saying?
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that, I think what could have happened here was the appellant could have called the commandant or could have called the deputy commandant and said, please tell us what the conditions on death row are like. Please tell us what the conditions in maximum custody or protective custody are like, which is where he moved afterwards.
Are you aware of any regulations at the prison that detail what the regimen is on death row?
Yes, Your Honor. I think DOD, just one second, DOD instruction 1325.7 does have some description of what death row inmates have and don't have.
And what does that say?
DOD 1325.7 says that death row inmates are not available or don't have access to rehab programs, and also don't have access to work. But there are two problems with that, Your Honor. First of all, that was not put before the military judge at trial. And the second problem with that...
We're doing a de novo review right now, right?
No, Your Honor, we're not. We are reviewing the military judge's findings for an abuse of discretion, to include his finding of fact that there was no intent to punish. The second problem, Your Honor, with the DOD instruction is that I think I understand what the regulation says, but there's evidence in the record here that he actually did have access to some of those things. If we look at the USDB risk assessment, which is at JA 564, we see that the appellant had extensive access to health care and mental health counseling. We also know that the appellant did have some access to vocation, and this is in Colonel Nance's letter at JA 204 and 205. We know that he had access to vocation. He was able to complete a 4-year Bible course. We know that he was able to complete a 6 to 8 month federal emergency management course. We also know that the appellant had access to his command. He received responses from the commandant, the deputy commandant, and the CJA. Now, the appellant seemed to say that that was not meaningful, but if you look at the response from the CJA, it appears that the CJA was trying to actually talk to appellant about the situation, but in that response there, it says that the appellant's attorney prohibited the CJA from speaking with appellant. So it looks like the command wanted to do more based on the record.
Well, counsel, doesn't it? I mean, doesn't it kind of strain credibility or credulity or whatever the right word is for us to say, oh, geez, holding him 287 days on death row, there's no problem there. If I ask the commandant, why did you hold him 287 days on death row, what would the commandant say?
Well, Your Honor, that might be helpful for us because at least that would be some evidence of what the command was doing, and I think that the appellant...
Well, can't we presume, and some kind of rebuttable presumption arise when you hold somebody on death row 280 days after they're supposed to be off?
No, Your Honor, I think...
You don't think so?
No, I don't think so. I think...
Well, what does that show?
I think the burden is on the appellant, Your Honor, to prove an Article 13 violation.
Well, if some kind of presumption arises, he's met that burden, hasn't he?
Well, Your Honor, I don't see in the case law any type of presumption, but I think, you know, again, is
there... Well, the case law talks about presumptions when you don't have a 305 hearing.
Yes, Your Honor, but we did have a 305 hearing here. And again, in the government's eyes, it was held at the correct time. But I think, you know...
You're trying to make too much out of this case, in my judgment.
Well, Your Honor, I understand.
Why don't you say the military judge did what he was supposed to do? He gave him 280 days credit or whatever he did and move on?
Well, Your Honor, because I think appellant failed in his evidentiary burden to prove an Article 13 violation.
Okay.
Should appellant have been removed from death row on June 28th? Yes. Was it a mistake to keep him there? Yes. Was it an Article 13 violation? No. Because the appellant failed to prove an intent to punish, and he also failed to prove under the rigorous circumstances.
More rigorous than necessary.
More rigorous than necessary.
So is the government left here to say death row is the ordinary place to keep people pending adjudication of a retrial and sentencing?
No, Your Honor. I'm not saying that. And I think a normal...
So why isn't it intuitive that it's more rigorous than necessary if that's not the normative way you treat someone who's pending sentence rehearing?
I think in a normal pretrial inmate case, Your Honor, it's different because you have to worry about the presumption of innocence there. If you have somebody who's truly pretrial, right, putting them on death row, I think, would overcome the presumption of innocence, which we don't have that problem here because the appellant stood convicted of several offenses. But it's not intuitive, Your Honor, again, because we know that people can spend years on death row as their cases progress through the system, and I don't think it's intuitive to say that that is necessarily more rigorous than, let's say, a solitary confinement or a suicide watch or something that's perhaps short-term.
Why isn't the affidavit adequate to raise a presumption of a violation of the second prong of Article 13, which the government then needs to rebut?
Lieutenant Ariano's affidavit, Your Honor?
The differences between the death row and protective custody inmates were significant. Death row inmates were locked in their cells for 23 hours a day.
I understand that, Your Honor. I don't see how that's any different than the time he spent at Lejeune afterwards. Apparently, he spent 23 hours a day in his cell at Camp Lejeune as well, so I don't see any difference there.
Lejeune Brig gets a lot of good press in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. And this motions hearing was about Camp Lejeune, Your Honor. If we put ourselves in the position of the command at the time, we have an order from TJAG saying conduct a 305 hearing. At the same time, we have a letter from the appellant's counsel saying, don't put me in pretrial, because pretrial, I'll have to go to Camp Lejeune, and I don't want to go to Camp Lejeune. And that's what it says right there.
Let's put Camp Lejeune aside for the second. Why isn't that affidavit, which says I was in my cell 23 hours a day, or he's saying the person was in his cell 23 hours a day, why doesn't that raise a presumption that that was more rigorous than necessary to make sure he showed up at his sentence rehearing?
For two reasons, Your Honor. Again, because I think it's consistent with the remainder of his pretrial confinement. So apparently security confinement officials determined that 23 hours a day was appropriate for him. And second, I know this court has said several times that we're not in the business of second-guessing decisions by
23 hours a day was required for his attendance at trial, keeping him in confinement 23 hours a day. How was that required to ensure his attendance at trial?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not really in a position to speculate on the security classification, but I think we need to defer to the confinement officials as to what his security, you know, classification was. And absent any evidence from the appellant as to how they arrived at that determination, I think that he has failed to meet his evidentiary burden.
Prior to the 305 hearing that the commander held, the appellant made several requests to be removed from death row. As I have read the record, he didn't make any request to be released pending the new trial. Where in the commander's 305 ruling does he address the necessity of keeping him on death row?
I don't think he does, Your Honor.
So all he talks about is the fact that it's not appropriate for him to be released. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So he doesn't really answer the question that we're here to address today.
I think you're right, Your Honor. And again,
so how come that isn't an abuse of discretion?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think we're looking at the commandant's abuse of discretion. We're looking at the military judge's abuse of discretion. To the extent that this is, I'm looking at the granted issue, I think the granted issue is Article 13. I think the granted issue is not RCM 305. I understand that the RCM 305 was raised at trial, but the granted issue is Article 13, so I think that is the scope of the review.
Well, that comes under 305K, doesn't it?
It's not limited to 305K, Your Honor.
No, but I mean the discretion given the judge to give additional credit.
I think so, Your Honor. That would be the mechanism to implement the Article 13.
If he had said, I find that was violated Article 13, but I don't find under the attendant circumstances of this case any additional credit other than one day for one should be given, what would we say then?
Well, Your Honor, I guess it would depend if appellant still raised the issue.
I mean, it would still be whether that abused his discretion or not, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, it's whether the military judge abused his discretion. But if we look at, if I could just turn quickly to the second prong of Article 13. Again, I think we just need to look past the label of death row. And if we look at the military judge's findings on the death row issue, he didn't make any findings of fact, or he didn't make any findings regarding unduly rigorous circumstances, again, because I don't think any evidence was introduced of what those circumstances was or were. He did make findings on intent to punish, but he did not make findings on unduly rigorous circumstances. And in that case, in that situation, I think this case...
It was an Article 13 motion, was it not?
Yes, Article 13 and 305.
But he only made findings then with one portion of Article 13, in your view?
I think so, Your Honor. I think that's consistent with the evidence that the appellant presented. Since there was no evidence of what the conditions were, I don't see why the judge should have to make any findings about what...
Should he then say there's no evidence that should make me make a finding then?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Just remain silent on that?
I think so. I mean, in that situation where there's no evidence, I think he can do what he did. But, you know, I think that this case, Your Honor, is similar to United States versus Mosby in terms of the evidence that was presented. In that case, this court found that other than the fact that the appellant introduced evidence that he was in solitary confinement, there was no evidence of intent to punish. And the court found against the appellant in that situation. In the end, Your Honor, appellant's claim ultimately boils down to no more than a violation of AR 190-47, which prohibits commingling of death and non-death prisoners. And this court has held that, again, violation of a service regulation is not per se punishment.
Well, what was the basis for that regulation?
As far as the reason that they prohibit that, Your Honor,
yeah.
I don't know the answer to that. I thought about it, but I think it's certainly not the same as normal commingling, which, again, where we have the presumption of innocence problem. I don't think we have that, again, in this case where the appellant stood convicted of several offenses. But pending any further questions from the court, the appellant failed to meet his evidentiary burden under Article 13, and the military judge properly found that there was no evidence from which to infer an intent to punish.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Is there a rebuttal?
Your Honor, United States versus Adcock informs, or should...
A little louder, please.
United States versus Adcock should inform this court's decision as to whether or not Article 13 credit should be awarded. In that particular case, although it's true, a violation of a regulation is not per se a violation of Article 13. In Adcock, it was determined that the confinement official knowingly and deliberately violated a regulation that was specifically designed to safeguard the rights of members, and that amounted to an abuse of discretion under RCN 305K. True here, as was in the case of Adcock, the purpose for non-commingling of death row inmates with death row inmates is to safeguard their safety. That would be one of the reasons for that regulation. True also in Adcock.
Did we find an Article 13 violation in Adcock?
You did.
Okay.
The court did, Your Honor, yes. And the cite to United States versus Adcock, it's in the briefs, but it's 65 MJ 18.
Counsel, you're saying knowingly and intentionally. Where is the knowing and intentionally here? Isn't it just as likely that no one knew quite to do with this individual? I mean, the CCA had done one thing. The case was coming up here. He was neither fish nor fowl in some sense.
If that's true, Your Honor, then we would maintain that that was a knowing indifference to the extent they didn't try to verify what they were required to do pertaining to my client. And in Adcock as well, this court indicated that there could be instances where a knowing indifference would allow for Article 13 credit. So in either event, knowing indifference or knowing and deliberate violation, we maintain that that would be a grounds.
Well, I mean, at one point, didn't the defense counsel even tell the SJA, you know, there's no case law directly on point as to what needs to happen with this guy? But we would like, mostly, they at one point just wanted him released.
Understood, Your Honor, but that doesn't explain...
I mean, wasn't that what they were fighting about, really? Not him being on death row. I mean, that was part of it, but the main issue was what to do with him at all.
Your Honor, we understand that there might be a discrepancy based on the Trial Defense Counsel's submission, but that doesn't explain why the commandant, the facility itself, had put Murphy, someone who was in the same situation, in general population, pending his appeal. There was precedence for this, and there was no explanation as to why my client was singled out to be treated in a different manner. With regard to the government's interpretation of Miller, it begs a question, and it harkens to United States versus Duncan, granted a Navy Marine Corps case, that said to adopt their position in terms of the ever expanding time frame for which they have to do a pretrial confinement review would create a virtually unlimited period during which an appellant could be wrongfully kept without rank or pay and a sentenced prisoner status with no lawful opportunity for judicial redress. The evidence of conditions being more onerous than necessary. In his affidavit, First Lieutenant Arellano spelled out the differences between death row status and those protective custody, said the differences were significant. Death row inmates were locked in their cells for 23 hours a day, 1 hour for recreation with one other inmate. Protective custody inmates were all housed together but could all interact with each other. They were segregated from the rest of the population. They recreationed together and ate meals together. Death row inmates were allowed to exit their cell to get their meal and return to their cell to eat. And if I want to emphasize once more to this court the importance of the evidence that there was an assessment done to my client in April 2004, almost immediately after the Army Corps set aside his death sentence, and it was deemed that he would be appropriately fit into medium custody, yet the confinement facility left him on death row.
What is the practical effect if we were to give additional credit?
Practical effect, Your Honor, is that sometime in the future, my client's indeterminate sentence of life possibility of parole could become a life sentence in terms of years, and the confinement credit could then be counted towards that time. So it would offer meaningful relief, as this court has discussed in Suzuki and Zarbitani most recently.
And would 280 days be meaningful relief?
It would, but it wouldn't meet, it wouldn't be responsive, entirely responsive to
the issue. Well, responsive, in the requirement that it be meaningful.
Meaningful, and that you...
And not disproportionate.
And not disproportionate, Your Honor. Disproportionate in this case would obviously be asking to set aside his dishonorable discharge.
Or asking for 2,800 days.
We maintain that based on the harm that he, no, Your Honor, we maintain that based on the harm that he suffered, that amount of time would be appropriate. In conclusion, Your Honors, at this time, appellant asks this court to remedy the government's unlawful action in keeping him on death row, just as this court provided what remedy it could back on January 5th, 2005, by ordering his release from death row. While appellant faces a sentence of life with the possibility of parole, his sentence could become determinate, to which confinement credit could then be applied. Granting appellant a request for relief of 2,880 days, 10 days for each day the government violated his Article 13 rights, will provide him with meaningful relief.
And thank you, counsel. The court thanks both counsel. The case is now submitted, and we will stand in recess until quarter past the hour.
Court stands in recess until 10:15.